Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gatehouse Florida. Welcome, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, and I'm joined as always by Gatehouse Florida Capitol correspondent John Kennedy. Hey, John.
Hi, Zach.
Well, happy 4th of July, everybody. Hope all of you IFP listeners get to enjoy the holiday and celebrate our independence from those blokes across the pond. The American women's soccer team delivered this week with a big win over England, which was very fitting. I turned on the World Cup game at work yesterday and tried to multitask and watch some soccer while I got some work done. And we're going to multitask today because there's plenty to cover in the world of Florida politics, including a raft of legal challenges aimed at a new law implementing the Felon Voting Rights Amendment to the state constitution, another big push to crack down on illegal immigration by the Florida GOP, and the six-month anniversary of Governor Ron DeSantis' administration. But first, I think, as George Bennett liked to say, I hear some royalty-free music. IFP listeners know what that music means. Get your pen and paper out and write down these numbers at the end of the show. We'll tell you what they mean in the world of Florida politics. John, what's your number today?
Zach, my number this week is 4. Very patriotic, as in 4th of July.
Right. Yeah, I like it. Right on theme. Well, I got that beat. My number is 86,184. So that's a patriotic 4 for John Kennedy and 86,184 for Zach Anderson. Well, it's one of those annual rites of late spring and early summer in Florida. Just as the birds are flying north for cooler temperatures, the lawsuits start flying over bills passed by the Florida legislature. From medical marijuana legislation to school voucher measures, GOP lawmakers often pass bills that Democrats and various activist groups end up challenging in court. And last Friday, Governor Ron DeSantis signed a bill implementing Amendment 4, the big felon voting rights amendment that was passed by voters last year. And of course, the bill was immediately challenged in court. John Kennedy, tell us a little bit about why people are so upset about this legislation.
Yeah, Zach, it took a little time for a host of interest groups to file lawsuits after Governor DeSantis signed that felon voting law into, enacted it. The key part of the fight is that the new law includes the requirement that court fines, fees, and restitution must be paid off by those felons before they can get their rights back. The fight over this money is a very familiar clash that carried through the legislative session. Remember those claims that it sounded like a segregation era poll tax? Well, voting rights activists say that these financial obligations may keep about half of what's considered to be about 1.4 million disenfranchised felons in Florida, may keep them off the voting rolls still. Voting rights and civil rights organizations have sued to have the new law declared unconstitutional. They claim it violates equal protection standards. It's a burdensome, amounts to an unconstitutional poll tax, limits political speech and rights to association, and it's a retroactive punishment that is also racially discriminatory. So they have a lot of things they're aiming at as they bring these federal lawsuits forward. Basically, this host of problems that many of these advocates like the NAACP, ACLU, and the Southern Poverty Law Center, they've warned legislators that this was what they were treading into by attaching payment to the right to vote. Even those supporting the amendment when it went to the ballot last fall, they had advocated that to be considered completing a criminal sentence, that felons would have had to pay whatever was ordered by a judge, that would be considered part of completing a criminal sentence. But, you know, it's a nuance there that is kind of hanging up where this legislation goes. The frustration is clearly there. A plaintiff in one of the lawsuits is Karen Light of Miami. She owes $59 million in restitution for insurance fraud, and she's paying that off, but as you can imagine, very slowly. Here she is testifying before a Senate committee a few months ago.
We're talking about restricting rights. And if you take this situation of having fines and restitution, $59 million, really? You think I can ever pay that? Never. I'll never vote in this state again.
And she went on to say that she feared basically that she will never become a real citizen again. Here's more from her.
I now have a passport. I was able to travel to Italy to my son's wedding this last year. So exciting. I mean, I'm like a citizen again, except for I still can't vote.
Well, she eventually did register to vote in April, at least according to the lawsuit. But she's one of those returning citizens that could be disqualified from voting under the new law. The courtroom fight in Florida, you know, is going to be one of the most consequential disputes of the 2020 election, I think. It's, 1.4 million disenfranchised. We're talking about 10% of the number of eligible voters in Florida. Getting them on the rolls could have a huge effect on the presidential election in this state. And that's why you're hearing both parties talking about this nationally. And there's also some history at play here. The judge assigned these consolidated cases because that's what they've done with these multiple lawsuits that have been filed. It's federal judge Mark Walker. He was the man who threw out Florida's cabinet-driven rights restoration system last year. He called it fatally flawed when he did that. And that basically gave momentum to the Amendment 4 campaign that eventually went to before voters in November. He's also clashed with Republican leaders over issues like early voting on college campuses. So going in, it would seem very hard not to believe that Walker will find some problems with this new law, given his views on voter access. Possibly he throws out with legislators did, demanding that they revisit the issue next session, which is late for voter restoration with an election looming. Or maybe he winds up crafting his own boundaries for how voting rights should be restored to this portion of the electorate. But this is going to be a wild ride on this one.
So based on the history of Judge Walker's rulings on voting issues, it seems likely that he could find some fault with this Amendment 4 implementing bill, but Republicans are trying very hard to convince him that this is a good piece of legislation. And one of the things that they're saying is that, look, when the advocates for Amendment 4 were campaigning, they were saying that, yes, in order to get your voting rights restored, you have to fully complete your sentence. And that includes paying things like, restitution and fines that are part of your sentence. And so now the GOP is saying that basically the Amendment 4 backers have changed their tune. What do you make of that, John?
Well, that is something that the Amendment 4 supporters are going to have to defend in court and explain that, because that was the lawyer for the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, John Mills, a longtime University of Florida law school dean and many other titles, a former state house speaker as well. He presented it that way to the Supreme Court when they were reviewing the proposed ballot language that went before voters. Now, I guess the nuance that I had made reference to earlier was he was careful in his remarks to talk about that basically whatever a judge ordered now, would be considered part of the criminal sentence, whatever it had to be paid. Now, a lot of these fines, fees, and other costs that people are facing may be related to just normal court costs that come with a criminal sentence. And in those cases, that is where the Amendment 4 advocates would argue people should not be prohibited from getting their rights restored. So it may come down to trying to parse into that database of how much money individuals owe, and which further complicates the issue is there is no database. So it's very hard to track exactly how much individuals owe, other than go into your civil or your the clerk of your local court and trying to get an answer to that question. It's a very loosely overseen system, it seems like, and that's part of the complexity right now too going forward.
Well, it's a hugely consequential court fight. I mean, there's no doubt that Amendment 4 is already has the potential to have a big impact on the election when you have all these newly eligible voters. But then, it depends on how many of these folks are actually going to be eligible. You know, is there going to be, this huge group, including the folks who have fines that are left unpaid, or are they going to be taken out? And it's quite possible that it could make a difference in who wins, Florida in 2020. So a big fight here. John Kennedy has been covering it for our Gatehouse publications around the state, and will continue to keep an eye on it. Has done some great reporting. This tug of war over Amendment 4 really caused a lot of contentious debate in the legislature this year, but it was far from the only divisive issue that lawmakers tackled. Immigration has also been a really hot button issue, really in all of American politics, ever since Trump descended down the escalator in Trump Tower and made targeting illegal immigrants a centerpiece of his campaign. And this year, Florida Republicans really jumped on the bandwagon and passed a big bill outlawing so-called sanctuary policies that limit local cities and counties from fully cooperating with federal immigration authorities. Well, this week, GOP leaders in Florida signaled that they're not done pursuing some of these hardline immigration policies. Round two appears to be coming next year. State Senator Joe Gruters, a Sarasota Republican who also chairs the Florida GOP, announced that he's going to travel around the state on a listening tour that's aimed at soliciting ideas for immigration legislation. Gruters sponsored that sanctuary city bill and said that he's already planning to sponsor another bill next year to implement E-Verify in Florida. If E-Verify became law of the land, it would mean that every business in Florida would have to check the immigration status of potential new hires, which is a big deal. Critics worry that it would cripple Florida's economy, but Gruters and others view it as a really effective way to deter illegal immigrants from coming to the country by ensuring that they can't get jobs. Gruters even traveled to the border between the United States and Mexico recently to demonstrate his commitment to the immigration issue. Here's a clip from a film that Gruters made about his trip to the border.
You know, a month ago, 1,000 illegal immigrants crossed the border just a stone's throw from here, the largest single group ever encountered. Our immigration system is shot. And what has Washington done? Nothing. They've completely failed us. We have a crisis at the border, and certainly you can't blame these families who are trying to come over. We obviously have to have compassion, but at the same time, trying to do what's right for our country. You know, my top priority is making sure that America is safe, because it's all about public safety. Can't have open borders, and one of the things we have to get under control is making sure that we understand who's coming into our system.
John Kennedy, I don't recall any other state lawmaker from Florida making a big show of traveling to the border, putting out a video like this. Does that show just how pervasive this issue has become in politics at all levels?
Oh, absolutely. And it shows just really the partisan divide on this, too. For somebody like Gruters, you know, state Republican chairman, this is something that, you know, just really feeds the base. I mean, Republicans in the state are, and many independent voters and a handful of Democrats as well, are alarmed at the immigration situation, the number of people that are in this country. And now, of course, the crisis at the border is a whole separate human rights issue as well. But I think for Republicans in the state, what Gruters did and what he looks like he's going to continue to try to advance with stricter steps toward immigration is something that they agree with. And it's a clear divide between Democrats and Republicans. We saw a lot of the discussion on in the Democratic debates a week ago in Miami being around the idea of decriminalizing border crossings and also trying to provide health care coverage to those who are in this country, whether they're documented or not. Those kind of issues, I think, really inflame Republicans. So this is one of those topics that Gruters can grab and run with and promise that he's going to bring it back next year in the legislature for even stricter enforcement. Now, of course, this issue of E-Verify gets very complicated because a lot of Republican interest groups, businesses, and the agriculture industry in the state do not want to see E-Verify enacted because, believe it or not, E-Verify is seen as something that actually may work and may keep undocumented people from being employed. And there are industries in this state, whether it's the service economy, the across Central Florida with the entertainment industries to people picking tomatoes in Western Palm Beach County. There's a lot of people that rely on illegal immigration in this state, and they don't want to see that workforce dry up.
You made a good point about how remarkable it is, the divide between the two parties on this issue right now. While the GOP is gearing up in Florida for another round of hardline immigration proposals. You saw the Democratic presidential candidates come to this state last week and really move to the left and looking to liberalize our immigration policies, no longer criminalize people for crossing the border, make it a civil violation, giving health care to undocumented immigrants, really the opposite direction that the GOP is moving. An interesting point that Republicans made during the sanctuary city debate is that this is an issue that polls really well in Florida. Governor Ron DeSantis was like, this is a no-brainer. I think even Democrats support this. And polls do show that a majority of Floridians did support outlawing these so-called sanctuary policies. So it'll be interesting to see who gets the upper hand here politically as we go into the 2020 election in a crucial battleground like Florida. Well, lastly, John, I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about an important milestone for Governor Ron DeSantis. The new governor is approaching his sixth-month anniversary on the job. You followed him from the beginning. Tell us a little bit about what DeSantis has achieved so far, how he's viewed by the public, where things are headed for this new governor.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, it'll be Monday, July 8th, the end of a big holiday weekend for many Floridians. It's going to be DeSantis's six-month mark as the state's chief executive, and he's done a lot. I mean, right now, he is drawing really strong approval ratings from Floridians. He's made it through his first legislative session with his goals mostly met, and since then, he's banked more than $700,000 from donors for his political spending committee. But, you know, the funny thing is that now comes the tricky part. He is in the process now of being a surrogate for President Trump. You know, he's out there where he owes Trump a debt from tweets that the president had sent out that helped rocket DeSantis to the Republican nomination last year. Now DeSantis is putting his own pretty strong brand on the idea of stumping for this not so popular chief executive who desperately needs to win Florida to punch his ticket for a second term. You know, it's funny, DeSantis has kind of downplayed this role as being a campaigner for the president. But when I talked to Gruters, the Sarasota Republican who is also the Republican Party chairman, he told me, quote, I actually think Ron DeSantis will be the main reason Donald Trump wins Florida. But if you look, you know, it's a lot of his policies and his political smarts. If he's able to translate this to the man whose tweets of support basically elevated him from being a little known Palm Coast congressman to the governor, There's a little bit of a yin and yang also at play with DeSantis's maneuvering. He was more popular with Floridians before the legislative session started, certainly with Democrats. This was according to polls. And early on, DeSantis rode this really big wave of well-received steps to what had been highest approval ratings in a decade for a Republican governor. He had this multi-billion-dollar, multi-year plan to improve Florida's environment, to lift the state's ban on smoking medical marijuana, and also to confront the state's dark racial history in pardoning the Groveland Four. But the legislative session included a lot of really kind of red meat Republican things as well. An expansion of private school vouchers, allowing for the arming of volunteer teachers as school guardians, sanctuary cities ban that again inflamed advocates for the immigrant community, and this massive toll road construction plan that was ridiculed by environmentalists and land planners. All that began cutting into DeSantis's crossover appeal. So now, you know, throw in President Trump and a presidential election, and it's hard to tell how the governor looks when, you know, 6 months turns into a year for him and the president's reelect is in full-on focus in Florida, which Trump, you know, really does seem to eagerly need to carry. And whether he can turn to his tweet friend to help him deliver, that's another question.
Yeah, DeSantis has been pretty savvy about how he has navigated his first few months in office, really seemed to reach across the aisle with a lot of the stuff that he did early on and probably made a good first impression with a lot of voters who were somewhat wary of him. But as you point out, once the rubber starts to meet the road and you start to sign some bills that might not be all that popular, you know, that could start to affect how he's perceived in the state. And, you know, with this 2020 election, I mean, that this will be a tricky line to walk for DeSantis, because Trump is obviously very polarizing and DeSantis is pretty tightly tied to the president. I mean, he can't really back away from him when Trump really helped, was the deciding factor in DeSantis winning the primary. And DeSantis is a big Trump supporter. I think he believes in a lot of what the president is doing. During Trump's rally recently in Orlando, DeSantis was there and Trump gave him a bunch of shout outs and complimented him for signing the Sanctuary City legislation. So these guys are pretty closely tied, and we'll see how that plays out over the 2020 campaign and whether it affects the governor's standing in Florida. All right, well, we're going to move on to our final segment here. And why don't we go from highest to lowest today? I'll start out. So 86,184 is the amount of money Sarasota State Representative Margaret Good raised in small dollar cash contributions from outside Florida. Why is that important? Well, fundraising is critical for political campaigns, and it's noteworthy that a candidate for a low profile state house seat could raise that much money from small donors in places like California and New York and other liberal states. It's really been made possible through online fundraising platforms, including a popular one called ActBlue that makes it really easy for donors to give money with just the click on their smartphone or in response to, you know, emails or texts from the candidates. And you can give money to multiple candidates at the same time. ActBlue really played an important role last year in helping Democrats win control of Congress and state legislatures around the country, including here in Florida. The Democrats didn't win control, but they flipped a number of GOP-held seats, including this seat in Sarasota that Margaret Good won. And a big reason that she won was that she was a fundraising juggernaut, which is not the typical for candidates here in Southwest Florida, which is pretty Republican-leaning. But she was able to tap into a broad donor base, including donors from outside the state who gave, you know, small contributions, but they really added up. And she really tapped into some energy that was in the Democratic Party, where you had donors in these liberal states like California who were already represented by Democrats, but they wanted to flip GOP-held seats. So this online fundraising platform made that possible for them to, you know, play in races in Florida and elsewhere. Well, Republicans have caught on to this, and they've unveiled a program called WinRed, which is an online fundraising platform that's supposed to kind of mirror ActBlue. President Trump was tweeting about this last week. Remains to be seen, though, whether the GOP can replicate the success that Democrats have had with ActBlue, but it's just a sign of how this fundraising arms race has entered an important new phase, and you're no longer restricted to the donors in your community or even your state. You can collect money from all over the country, and we've really seen that with candidates like Trump or Bernie Sanders or others be very successful, but Margaret Good and others show that you can do that at any level of politics these days. So, John, you had a four. It's the 4th of July here, and you're coming with a four. Very, very appropriate. What does that mean?
That's right. My red, white, and blue four actually has to do with the number of citizens' ballot proposals that are lining up before the Florida Supreme Court. Now, getting a constitutional amendment on the ballot isn't easy in Florida. You need to collect more than 766,000 petition signatures. But once you have at least 10% of that mark, you get to go before the justices, who will review your ballot language to make sure it's constitutional. Well, things are stacking up in the court. There are soon to be four very controversial ballot proposals going before the justices on their way, maybe eventually, to voters next November. Justices this week set August 28th as the date for arguments over a proposed constitutional amendment that effectively deregulates the utility industry. This is something that would give customers the power to choose their electrical provider and allow other companies than the state's big investor-owned utilities to generate and sell electrical power. It's going to be a big fight, with giant utilities like Florida Power and Light and Tampa Electric against the measure, which could bring competition and lower prices to power. At least that's according to the smaller power generators that are looking to enter the Florida market. Texas is a state that has a somewhat similar system. But this David versus Goliath fight, you know, it isn't the only measure that's lined up now before the justices. There's a proposal to increase the state's minimum wage. That's one that also is drawing a lot of attention from business groups that are opposed. It's designed to eventually bring the minimum wage up to $15 an hour. That's pushed by Orlando trial lawyer John Morgan, but that's ready for a date with the court very soon. Also, having gotten more than 10% of the signatures needed, is a proposal to expand Medicaid to about 1 million lower-income Floridians. And there's also another possible constitutional amendment to ban assault weapons. When you hear these, a sharp listener is going to detect a pattern here. These are citizens' initiatives that are a response to a Republican-controlled legislature where a lot of these ideas have gone only to fail. It's basically how past initiatives have brought us expanded medical marijuana and required environmental spending. Groups turn to the court and the ballot when they feel that the legislature is not listening to what the public wants. And it looks pretty much like that this presidential election ballot, while already very much focused on that race for the White House, that it's going to be chock full of even more controversial issues. So, you know, once voters get past that simple issue about who's going to be in the White House for the next 4 years, they can start wrestling with all these other things before Florida.
Yeah, ballot initiatives are always important to watch in Florida. These grassroots groups have had a lot of success going directly to voters with issues like you mentioned, medical marijuana, smaller class sizes, Amendment 4. Some huge changes in Florida have come through the constitutional amendment process. So you IFP listeners will want to keep an eye on those as they progress through the system here. Well, that wraps up another edition of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production team of Thomas Porty, Joseph Forzano, and Adam Fish. And thanks to all of you for listening. We're out of here.